You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Chapter 5 of A Popular History of Ireland, Book 1. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. A Popular History of Ireland, From the Earliest Periods to the Emancipation of the Catholics, Book 1, by Thomas D'Arcy McGee. Chapter 5. The Reign of Hugh II. The Irish Colony in Scotland Obtains Its Independence. 27 years is a long reign, and the events of King Hugh II were marked with striking events. One religious and one political occurrence, however, threw all others into the shade, the conversion of the Highlands and Islands of Scotland, then called Alba or Alban by the Gael, and Caledonia by the Latins, and the formal recognition, after an exciting controversy, of the independence of the Milesian colony in Scotland. The first authentic Irish immigration into Scotland seems to have taken place about the year of our Lord 258. The pioneers crossed over from Antrim to Argyll, where the strait is less than 25 miles wide. Other adventurers followed at intervals, but it is a fact to be deplored that no passages in all our own and in all other histories have been so carelessly kept as the records of immigration. The movements of rude masses of men, the first founders of states and cities, are generally lost in obscurity or misrepresented by patriotic zeal. Several successive settlements of the Irish in Caledonia can be faintly traced from the middle of the 3rd till the beginning of the 6th century. About the year 503 they had succeeded in establishing a flourishing principality among the cliffs and glens of Argyll. The limits of their first territory cannot be exactly laid down, but it soon spread north into Ross-shire, and east into the present county of Perth. It was a land of stormy friths and fissured headlands, of deep defiles and snowy summits. "'Tis a far cry to Loch Awe," is still a lowland proverb, and Loch Awe was in the very heart of that old Irish settlement. The earliest immigrants to Argyll were pagans, while the latter were Christians and were accompanied by priests and a bishop, Ciaran, the son of the carpenter, whom from his youthful piety and holy life, as well as from the occupation followed by his father, is sometimes fancifully compared to our Lord and Saviour himself. Parishes in Cantyre, Islay, and Carrick still bear the name of St. Ciaran as a patron. But no systematic attempt, none at least of historic memory, was made to convert the remoter Gael and the other races then inhabiting the Alba, the Picts, the Britons, and Scandinavians, until the year of our era, 565, Columba, or Columkill, a bishop of the race of Niall, undertook that task on a scale commensurate with its magnitude. This celebrated man has always ranked with St. Patrick and St. Bridget as the most glorious triad of the Irish calendar. He was, at the time he left Ireland, in the prime of his life, his 44th year. 12 companions, the apostolic number, accompanied him on his voyage. For 34 years he was the legislator and captain of Christianity in those northern regions. The king of the Picts received baptism at his hands. The king of the Scottish colony, his kinsman, received the crown from him on their accession. The islet of Eye, or Ionia, was presented to him by one of these princes. Here he and his companions built with their own hands their parent house, and from this Hebridean rock in after times was shaped the destinies, spiritual and temporal, of many tribes and kingdoms. The growth of Ionia was as the growth of the grain of a mustard seed mentioned in the Gospel, even during the life of its founder. Formed by his teaching and example, there went out from it apostles to Iceland, to the Orkneys, to Northumbria, to Man, and to South Britain. 100 monasteries in Ireland looked to that exiled saint as their patriarch. His rule of monastic life, adopted either from the Far East, from the recluses of the Thebaid, or from his great contemporary, Saint Benedict, was sought for by chiefs, bards, and converted druids. Clients seeking direction from his wisdom, or protection through his power, were constantly arriving and departing from his sacred isle. His days were divided between manual labor and the study and transcribing of the sacred scriptures. He and his disciples, says the venerable Bede, in whose age Ionia still flourished, neither thought of nor loved anything in this world. Some writers have represented Columbkill's coleys, which in English simply means servants of God, as a married clergy. So far is this from the truth, that we now know no woman was allowed to land on the island, nor even a cow to be kept there. For, said the holy woman, wherever there is a cow there will be a woman, and wherever there is a woman there will be mischief. In the reign of King Hugh, three domestic questions arose of great importance. One was the refusal of the Prince of Ossory to pay tribute to the monarch, the other the proposed extinction of the Bardic order, and the third the attempt to tax the Argyll colony. The question between Ossory and Tara we may pass over as of obsolete interest, but the other two deserve fuller mention. The bards, who were the editors, professors, registrars, and record-keepers, the makers and masters of public opinion in those days, had reached in this reign a number exceeding 1,200 in Meath and Ulster alone. They claimed all the old privileges of free quarters on their travels and freeholdings at home, which were freely granted their order when it was in its infancy. Those chieftains who refused them anything, however extravagant, they lampooned and libelled, exciting their own people and other princes against them. Such was their audacity that some of them are said to have demanded from King Hugh the royal brooch, one of the most highly prized heirlooms of the reigning family. Twice in the early part of this reign they had been driven from the royal residence, and obliged to take refuge in the little principality of Ulidia, or Down. The third time the monarch had sworn to expel them utterly from the kingdom. In Columbkill, however, they were destined to find a most powerful mediator, both from his general sympathy with the order, being himself no mean poet, and from the fact that the then arch-poet, or chief of the order, Dallan Forgaill, was one of his own pupils. To settle this vexed question of the bards, as well as to obtain the sanction of the estates to the taxation of Argyll, King Hugh called a general assembly in the year 590. The place of meeting was no longer the interdicted Tara, but for the monarch's convenience a site farther north was chosen, the hill of Dromcath, in the present county of Derry. Here came in rival state and splendour the princes of the four provinces, and other principal chieftains. The dignitaries of the church also attended, and an occasional druid was perhaps to be seen in the train of some unconverted prince. The pretensions of the mother country to impose a tax upon her colony were sustained by the profound learning of the venerable name of St. Colman, Bishop of Dromore, one of the first men of his order. When Columbkill heard of the calling together of that general assembly, and of the questions to be there decided, he resolved to attend, notwithstanding the stern vow of his earlier life, never to look on Irish soil again. Under a scruple of this kind, he is said to have remained blindfold, from his arrival in his fatherland until his return to Ionia. He was accompanied by an imposing train of attendants, by Aidan, Prince of Argyll, so deeply interested in the issue, and a suite of over 100 persons, 20 of them abbots or bishops. Columbkill spoke for his companions, for already, as in Bede's time, the abbots of Ionia exercised over all the clergy north of the Humber, but still more directly north of the Tweed, a species of supremacy similar to that which the successors of St. Benedict and St. Bernard exercised, in turn, over prelates and princes on the European continent. When the assembly was opened, the holy bishop of Dromore stated the arguments in favour of colonial taxation, with learning and effect. Hugh himself impeached the bards for their licentious and lawless lives. Columbkill defended both interests, and by combining both, probably strengthened the friends of each. It is certain that he carried the assembly with him, both against the monarch and those of the resident clergy, who had selected Colman as their spokesman. The bardic order was spared. The doctors, or master singers among them, were prohibited from wandering from place to place. They were assigned residence with the chiefs and princes, Their loose attendants were turned over to honest pursuits, and thus a great danger was averted, and one of the most essential of the Celtic institutions being reformed and regulated was preserved. Scotland and Ireland have good reason to be grateful to the founder of Iona for the interposition that preserved to us the music, which is now admitted to be one of the most precious inheritances of both countries. The proposed taxation Columbkill strenuously and successfully resisted. Up to this time the colonists had been bound only to furnish a contingent force, by land and sea, when the King of Ireland went to war, and to make them an annual present called chief rent. From the Book of Rights we learn that, at least at the time the existing transcript was made, the Scottish princes paid out of Alba 7 shields, 7 steeds, 7 bondswomen, 7 bondsmen, and 7 hounds, all of the same breed. But the chief rent, or eric for kindly blood, did not suffice in the year 590 to satisfy King Hugh. The colony had grown great, and like some modern monarchs, he proposed to make it pay for its success. Columbkill, though a native of Ireland and a prince of its reigning house, was by choice a resident of Caledonia, and he stood true to his adopted country. The Irish king refused to continue the connection on the old conditions, and declared his intention to visit Alba himself to enforce the tribute due. Columbkill, rising in the assembly, declared the Albanians for ever free from the yoke, and this, adds an old historian, turned out to be the fact. From the whole controversy we may conclude that Scotland never paid political tribute to Ireland, that their relation was that rather of allies than of sovereign and vassal, that it resembled more the homage Carthage paid to Tyre and Syracuse to Corinth than any modern form of colonial dependence, that a federal connection existed by which, in time of war, the Scots of Argyll and those of Hibernia were mutually bound to aid, assist, and defend each other. And this natural and only connection, founded in the blood of both nations, sanctioned by their early saints, confirmed by frequent intermarriage, by a common language and literature, and by hostility to common enemies, the Saxons, Danes, and Normans, grew into a political bond of unusual strength, and was cherished with affection by both nations, long after the magnates assembled at Dromcath had disappeared in the tombs of their fathers. The only unsettled question which remained after the assembly at Dromcath related to the Prince of Ossory. 5 years afterwards, A.D. 595, King Hugh fell in an attempt to collect the special tribute from all Leinster, of which we have already heard something, and shall by and by hear more. He was an able and energetic ruler, and we may be sure did not let the sun rise on him in his bed at Tara, or anywhere else. In his time great internal changes were taking place in the state of society. The ecclesiastical order had become more powerful than any other in the state. The bardic order, thrice prescribed, were finally subjected to the laws, over which they had at one time insolently domineered. Ireland's only colony, unless we except the immature settlement on the Isle of Man, under Cormac Longbeard, was declared independent of the parent country, through the moral influence of its illustrious apostle, whose name many of its kings and nobles were of old proud to bear, Malcolm, meaning servant of Colum or Columbkill. But the memory of the sainted statesman who decreed the separation of the two populations, so far as claims to taxation could be preferred, preserved for ages the better and far more profitable alliance of an ancient friendship, unbroken by a single national quarrel during 1,000 years. A few more words on the death and character of this celebrated man, whom we are now to part with at the close of the 6th, as we parted from Patrick at the close of the 5th century. His day of departure came in 596. Death found him at the ripe old age of almost 80, stylus in hand, toiling cheerfully over the vellum page. It was the last night of the week when the presentiment of his end came strongly upon him. This day, he said to his disciple and successor, Dermid, is called the day of rest, and such it will be for me, for it will finish my labors. Laying down the manuscript, he added, let Baithen finish the rest. Just after Matan, on the Sunday morning, he passed peacefully away from the midst of his brethren. Of his tenderness, as well as energy of character, tradition, and his biographers have recorded many instances. Among others, his habit of ascending an eminence every evening at sunset, to look over towards the coast of his native land. This spot is called by the islanders to this day the place of the back turned upon Ireland. The fishermen of the Hebrides long believed they could see their saint flitting over the waves after every new storm, counting the islands to see if any of them had foundered. It must have been a lovable character of which such tales could be told and cherished from generation to generation. Both education and nature had well fitted Columbkill to the great task of adding another realm to the empire of Christendom. His princely birth gave him power over his own proud kindred, his golden eloquence and glowing verse, the fragments of which still move and delight the Gaelic scholar, gave him fame and weight in the Christian schools which had suddenly sprung up in every glen and island. As a prince he stood on equal terms with princes, as a poet he was affiliated to that all-powerful bardic order, before whose awful anger kings trembled, and warriors succumbed in superstitious dread. A spotless soul, a disciplined body, an indomitable energy, an industry that never wearied, a courage that never blanched, a sweetness and courtesy that won all hearts, a tenderness for others that contrasted strongly with his rigor towards himself, these were the secrets of the success of this eminent missionary, these were the miracles by which he accomplished the conversion of so many barbarous tribes and pagan princes. End of chapter 5.
Chapter 6 of A Popular History of Ireland, Book 1. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Sharon Bautista. A Popular History of Ireland, From the Earliest Period to the Emancipation of the Catholics, Book 1. By Thomas D'Arcy McGee. Chapter 6. Kings of the 7th Century. The 5 years of the 6th century, which remained after the death of Hugh II, were filled by Hugh III, son of Dermid the semi-pagan. Hugh IV succeeded, AD 599, and reigned for several years. Two other kings, of small account, reigned 7 years. Donald II, AD 624, reigned 16 years. Conall and Kellach, brothers, AD 640, reigned jointly 16 years. They were succeeded, AD 656, by Dermid and Blathmuc, brothers, who reigned jointly 7 years. Shinasag, son of the former, reigned 6 years. Kinfala, 4. Finacta, the hospitable, 20 years. And Loingsec, AD 693, 8 years. Throughout this century, the power of the Church was constantly on the increase and is visible in many important changes. The last armed struggle of Druidism and the only invasion of Ireland by the Anglo-Saxons are also events of the civil history of the 7th century. The reign of Donald II is notable for the passing away of most of those saintly men, the second generation of Irish abbots and bishops, for the foundation of the celebrated school of Lismore on the Munster Blackwater, and the Battle of Moira in the present county of Down. Of the school and the saints we shall speak hereafter. The battle deserves more immediate mention. The cause of the battle was the pretension of the petty Prince of Ulidia, which comprised little more than the present county of Down, to be recognized as Prince of all Ulster. Now the Hy Nial family not only had long given monarchs to all Ireland, but had also the lion's share of their own province, and King Donald as their head could not permit their ascendancy to be disputed. The ancestors of the present pretender, Congal, surnamed the Squint-Eyed, had twice received and cherished the licentious bards when under the ban of Tara, and his popularity with that still powerful order was one prop of his ambition. It is pretty clear also that the last rally of Druidism against Christianity took place behind his banner on the plain of Moira. It was the year 637, and preparations had long gone on both sides for a final trial of strength. Congal had recruited numerous bands of Saxons, Britons, Picts, and Argyle Scots, who poured into the larbours of Down for months, and were marshalled on the banks of the Lagan to sustain his cause. The poets of succeeding ages have dwelt much in detail on the occurrences of this memorable day. It was what might strictly be called a pitched battle, time and place being fixed by mutual agreement. King Donald was accompanied by his bard, who described to him, as they came in sight, the several standards of Congal's host, and who served under them. Conspicuous above all, the ancient banner of the Red Branch Knights, a yellow lion wrought on green satin, floated over Congal's host. On the other side, the monarch commanded in person, accompanied by his kinsmen, the sons of Hugh the Third. The red hand of Tirwin, the cross of Tyrconnell, the eagle and lion of Inishowen, the axes of Fanad, were in his ranks, ranged closely round his own standard. The cause of the constitution and the church prevailed, and Druidism mourned its last hope extinguished on the plains of Moira, in the death of Congal and the defeat of his vast army. King Donald returned in triumph to celebrate his victory at Emania and to receive the benediction of the church at Armagh. The sons of Hugh III, Dermid and Blathmach, zealous and pious Christian princes, survived the field of Moira and other days of danger, and finally attained the supreme power, AD 656. Like the two kings of Sparta, they reigned jointly, dividing between them the labors and cares of state. In their reign, that terrible scourge, called in Irish the Yellow Plague, after ravaging a great part of Britain, broke out with undiminished virulence in Erin, AD 664. To heighten the awful sense of inevitable doom, an eclipse of the sun occurred concurrently with the appearance of the pestilence on the first Sunday in May. It was the season when the ancient sun god had been accustomed to receive his annual oblations, and we can well believe that those whose hearts still trembled at the name of Bel must have connected the eclipse and the plague with the revolution in the national worship and the overthrow of the ancient gods on that plain of prostration, where they had so long received the homage of an entire people. Among the victims of this fearful visitation, which, like the modern cholera, swept through all ranks and classes of society, and returned in the same track for several successive seasons, were very many of those venerated men, the third and fourth generation of the abbots and bishops. The Munster king and many of the chieftain class shared the common lot. Lastly, the royal brothers fell themselves victims to the epidemic, which so sadly signalizes their reign. The only conflicts that occurred on Irish soil with a Pictish or an Anglo-Saxon force, if we accept those who formed a contingent of Congal's army at Moira, occurred in the time of the hospitable Finacta. The Pictish force, with their leaders, were totally defeated at Rathmore in Antrim, AD 680. But the Anglo-Saxon expedition, AD 684, seems not to have been either expected or guarded against. As leading to the mention of other interesting events, we must set this inroad clearly before the reader. The Saxons had now been for four centuries in Britain, the older inhabitants of which, Celts, like the Gauls and Irish, they had cruelly harassed, just as the Milesian Irish oppressed their Belgic predecessors, and as the Normans, in turn, will be found oppressing both Celt and Saxon in England and Ireland. Britain had been divided by the Saxon leaders into eight separate kingdoms, the people and princes of several of which were converted to Christianity in the 5th, 6th, and 7th century, though some of them did not receive the gospel before the beginning of the 8th. The Saxons of Kent and the southern kingdoms generally were converted by missionaries from France or Rome, or native preachers of the first or second Christian generation. Those of Northumbria recognize as their apostles St. Aidan and St. Cuthbert, two fathers from Iona. The Kingdom of Northumbria, as the name implies, embraced nearly all the country from the Humber to the Pictish border. York was its capital and the seat of its ecclesiastical primacy, where, at the time we speak of, the illustrious Wilfrid was maintaining, with a willful and unscrupulous king, a struggle not unlike that which Becket maintained with Henry II. This prince, Egfrid by name, was constantly engaged in wars with his Saxon contemporaries, or the Picts and Scots. In the summer of 683, he sent an expedition under the command of Bjort, one of his earls, to ravage the coast of Leinster. Bjort landed probably in the Boyne and swept over the rich plain of Meath with fire and sword, burning churches, driving off herds and flocks, and slaughtering the clergy and the husbandmen. The piety of an after age saw in the retribution which overtook Egfrid the following year, when he was slain by the Picts and Scots, the judgment of heaven, avenging the unprovoked wrongs of the Irish. His Scottish conquerors, returning good for evil, carried his body to Iona, where it was interred with all due honor. Iona was now in the zenith of its glory. The barren rock, about 3 miles in length, was covered with monastic buildings, and its cemetery was already adorned with the tombs of saints and kings. 5 successors of Columbkill slept in peace around their holy founder, and a 6th, equal in learning and sanctity to any who preceded him, received the remains of King Egfrid from the hands of his conquerors. This was Abbot Adamnan, to whom Ireland and Scotland are equally indebted for his admirable writings, and who might also dispute with Bede himself the title of Father of British History. Adamnan regarded the fate of Egfrid, we may be sure, in the light of a judgment on him for his misdeeds, as Bede and British Christians very generally did. He learned, too, that there were in Northumbria several Christian captives, carried off in Bjort's expedition and probably sold into slavery. Now every missionary that ever went out from Iona had taught that to reduce Christians to slavery was wholly inconsistent with a belief in the doctrines of the gospel. St. Aidan, the apostle of Northumbria, had refused the late Egfrid's father's absolution, on one occasion, until he solemnly promised to restore their freedom to certain captives of this description. In the same spirit, Adamnan voluntarily undertook a journey to York, where Aldfrid, a prince educated in Ireland and whose itinerary of Ireland we still have, now reigned. The abbot of Iona succeeded in his humane mission, and crossing over to his native land, he restored 60 of the captives to their homes and kindred. While the liberated exiles rejoiced on the plain of Meath, the tent of the abbot of Iona was pitched on the Rath of Tara, a fact which would seem to indicate that already, in little more than a century since the interdict had fallen on it, the edifices which made so fine a show in the days of Patrick were ruined and uninhabitable. Either at Tara or some of the royal residences, Adamnan on this visit procured the passing of a law, AD 684, forbidding women to accompany an army to battle or to engage personally in the conflict. The mild maternal genius of Christianity is faithfully exhibited in such a law, which consummates the glory of the worthy successor of Columbkill. It is curious here to observe that it was not until another 100 years had passed, not till the beginning of the 9th century, that the clergy were exempt from military service. So slow and patient is the process by which Christianity infuses itself into the social life of a converted people. The long reign of Finacta, the hospitable, who may, for his many other virtues, be also called the pious, was rendered farther remarkable in the annals of the country by the formal abandonment of the special tax, so long levied upon and so long and desperately resisted by the men of Leinster. The all-powerful intercessor in this case was St. Moling, of the royal house of Leinster, and Bishop of Fernamore, now Ferns. In the early part of his reign, Finacta seems not to have been disposed to collect this invidious tax by force. But yielding to other motives, he afterwards took a different view of his duty, and marched into Leinster to compel its payment. Here, the holy prelate of Ferns met him, and related a vision in which he had been instructed to demand the abolition of the impost. The abolition, he contended, should not be simply a suspension, but final and forever. The tribute was, at this period, enormous, 15,000 head of cattle annually. The decision must have been made about the time that Abbot Adamnan was in Ireland. AD 684, and that illustrious personage is said to have been opposed to the abolition. Abolished it was, and though its reenactment was often attempted, the authority of St. Maling's solemn settlement prevented it from being reinforced for any length of time, except as a political or military infliction. Finacta fell in battle in the 20th year of his long and glorious reign, and is commemorated as a saint in the Irish calendar. St. Maling survived him 3 years, and St. Adamnan, so intimately connected with his reign, 10 years. The latter revisited Ireland in 697, under the short reign of Loingsech, and concerned himself chiefly in endeavoring to induce his countrymen to adopt the Roman rule, as to the tonsure and the celebration of Easter. On this occasion there was an important synod of the clergy under the presidency of Flann, Archbishop of Armagh, held at Tara. Nothing could be more natural than such an assembly, in such a place, at such a period. In every recorded instance, the power of the clergy had been omnipotent in politics for above a century. St. Patrick had expurgated the old constitution. St. Ruadan's curse drove the kings from Tara. St. Columbkill had established the independence of Alba and preserved the Bardic order. St. Maling had abolished the Leinster tribute. If their power was irresistible in the 6th and especially in the 7th centuries, we must do these celebrated abbots and bishops the justice to remember that it was always exercised against the oppression of the weak by the strong, to mitigate the horrors of war, to uphold the right of sanctuary, the habeas corpus of that rude age, and for the maintenance and spread of sound Christian principles. End of chapter 6. Recording by Sharon Bautista in Evanston, Illinois.
Chapter 7 of A Popular History of Ireland, Book 1. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. A Popular History of Ireland, From the Earliest Period to the Emancipation of the Catholics. Book 1. By Thomas D'Arcy McGee. Chapter 7. Kings of the 8th Century. The kings of the 8th century are Congal II, surnamed Kenmare, who reigned 7 years, Fergal, who reigned 10 years, Forgarta, Kenneth, Flaherty, respectively 1, 4, and 7 years. Hugh V, surnamed Alan, 9 years. Donald III, who reigned AD 739 to 759, 20 years. Neil II, surnamed Neil of the Showers, 7 years. And Donogh I, who reigned 31 years, AD 766 to 797. The obituaries of these kings show that we have fallen on a comparatively peaceful age, since of the entire 9, but 3 perished in battle. One retired to Armagh, and one to Iona, where both departed in the monastic habit. The others died either of sickness or old age. Yet the peaceful character of this century is but comparative, for in the first quarter, AD 722, we have the terrible Battle of Almaine, between Leinster and the Monarch, in which 30,000 men were stated to have engaged, and 7,000 to have fallen. The Monarch, who had double the number of the Leinster prince, was routed and slain, apropos of which we have a bardic tale told, which almost transports one to the far east, the simple lives and awful privileges of the Hindu Brahmins. It seems that some of King Fergal's army, in foraging for their fellows, drove off the only cow of a hermit, who lived in seclusion near a solitary little chapel called Killin. The enraged recluse, at the very moment the armies were about to engage, appeared between them, regardless of personal danger, denouncing ruin and death to the monarch's forces, and in this case, as in others, to be found in every history, the prophecy, no doubt, helped to produce its own fulfillment. The malediction of men dedicated to the service of God has often routed hosts as gallant as were marshalled on the field of Almain. Fergal's two immediate successors met a similar fate, death in the field of battle, after very brief reigns, of which we have no great events to record. Flaherty, the next who succeeded, after a vigorous reign of 7 years, withdrew from the splendid cares of a crown, and passed the long remainder of his life, 30 years, in the habit of a monk at Armagh. The heavy burthen which he had cheerfully laid down was taken up by a prince, who combined the twofold character of poet and hero. Hugh V, surnamed Alan, the son of Fergal, of whom we have just spoken, was the very opposite of his father in his veneration for the privileges of holy persons and places. His first military achievement was undertaken in vindication of the rights of those who were unable by arms to vindicate their own. Hugh Rowan, prince of the troublesome little principality of Ulidia, Down, though well stricken in years and old enough to know better, in one of his excursions had forcibly compelled the clergy of the country through which he passed to give him free quarters, contrary to the law everywhere existing. Congus, the primate, jealous of the exemptions of his order, complained of this sacrilege in a poetic message addressed to Hugh Allen, who, as a Christian and a prince, was bound to espouse his quarrels. He marched into the territory of the offender, defeated him in battle, cut off his head on the threshold of the church of Faugard, and marched back again, his host chanting a war song composed by their leader. In this reign died St. Gerald of Mayo, an Anglo-Saxon bishop, and apparently the head of a colony of his countrymen, from whom that district is ever since called Mayo of the Saxons. The name, however, being a general one for strangers from Britain about that period, just as Dane became for foreigners from the Baltic in the next century, is supposed to be incorrectly applied, the colony being, it is said, really from Wales, of old British stock, who had migrated rather than live under the yoke of their victorious Anglo-Saxon kings. The descendants of these Welshmen are still to be traced, though intimately intermingled with the original Belgic and later Milesian settlers in Mayo, Sligo, and Galway, thus giving a peculiar character to that section of the country, easily distinguishable from all the rest. Although Hugh Allen did not imitate his father's conduct towards ecclesiastics, he felt bound by all ruling custom to avenge his father's death. In all ancient countries, the kinsmen of a murdered man were both by law and custom the avengers of his blood. The members of the Greek fratri, of the Roman fatria, or gens, of the Germanic and Anglo-Saxon guild, and of the medieval sworn commune, were all solemnly bound to avenge the blood of any of their brethren, unlawfully slain. So that the repulsive repetition of reprisals, which so disgusts the modern reader in our old annals, is by no means a phenomenon peculiar to the Irish state of society. It was, in the Middle Age and in early times, common to all Europe, to Britain and Germany, as well as to Greece and Rome. It was, doubtless, under a sense of duty of this sort that Hugh V led into Leinster a large army, AD 733, and the day of Athsenaid fully atoned for the day of Almain. 9,000 of the men of Leinster were left on the field, including most of their chiefs, the victorious monarch losing a son and other near kinsmen. 4 years later, he himself fell in an obscure contest near Kells, in the plain of Meath. Some of his quatrains have come down to us, and they breathe a spirit at once religious and heroic, such as must have greatly endeared the prince, who possessed it, to his companions in arms. We are not surprised, therefore, to find his reign a favorite epoch with subsequent bards and storytellers. The long and prosperous reign of Donald III succeeded, A.D. 739 to 759. He is almost the only one of this series of kings of whom it can be said that he commanded in no notable battle. The annals of his reign are chiefly filled with ordinary accidents and the obits of the learned. But its literary and religious records abound with bright names and great achievements, as we shall find when we come to consider the educational and missionary fruits of Christianity in the 8th century. While on a pilgrimage to Duro, a famous Columbian foundation in Meath, and present King's County, Donald III departed this life, and in Duro, by his own desire, his body was interred. Neil II, surnamed of the Showers, son to Fergal and brother of the warrior bard Hugh V, was next invested with the white wand of sovereignty. He was a prince less warlike and more pious than his elder brother. The soubriquet attached to his name is accounted for by a bardic tale, which represents him as another Moses, at whose prayer food fell from heaven in time of famine. Whatever showers fell or wonders were wrought in his reign, it is certain that after enjoying the kingly office for 7 years, Neil resigned and retired to Iona, there to pass the remainder of his days in penance and meditation. 8 years he led the life of a monk in that sacred isle, where his grave is one of those of the three Irish kings, still pointed out in the cemetery of the kings. He is but one among several princes, his contemporaries, who had made the same election. We learn in this same century that Kellach, son of the king of Connacht, died in holy orders, and that Bec, prince of Alidia, and Ardgal, son of a later king of Connacht, had taken the cross-staff of the pilgrim, either for Iona or Armagh, or some more distant shrine. Pilgrimages to Rome and to Jerusalem seem to have been begun even before this time, as we may infer from St. Adamnan's work on the situation of the holy places, of which Bede gives an abstract. The reign of Donogh I is the longest and the last among the kings of the 8th century, A.D. 776 to 797. The kings of Ireland had now not only abandoned Tara, but one by one the other royal residences in Meath as their usual place of abode. As a consequence, a local sovereignty sprung up in the family of O'Melaghlin, a minor branch of the ruling race. This house, developing its power so unexpectedly, and almost always certain to have the national forces under the command of a patron prince at their back, were soon involved in quarrels about boundaries, both with Leinster and Munster. King Donogh, at the outset of his reign, led his forces into both principalities, and without battle received their hostages. Giving hostages, generally the sons of the chiefs, was the usual form of ratifying any treaty. Generally also, the bishop of the district, or its most distinguished ecclesiastic, was called in as witness of the terms, and both parties were solemnly sworn on the relics of saints, the gospels of the monasteries or cathedrals, or the croziers of their venerated founders. The breach of such a treaty was considered a violation of the relics of the saint, whose name had been invoked, and awful penalties were expected to follow so heinous a crime. The hostages were then carried to the residence of the king, to whom they were entrusted, and while the peace lasted, enjoyed a parole freedom and every consideration due to their rank. If of tender age, they were educated with the same care as the children of the household. But when war broke out, their situation was always precarious, and sometimes dangerous. In a few instances they had even been put to death, but this was considered a violation of all the laws, both of hospitality and chivalry. Usually they were removed to some strong secluded fort, and carefully guarded as pledges to be employed, according to the chances and changes of the war. That Donogh preferred negotiation to war, we may infer by his course towards Leinster and Munster, in the beginning of his reign, and his kingly parley at a later period, A.D. 783, with Fiachna of Ulidia, son of that over-exacting Hugh Rowan, whose head was taken from his shoulders at the church door of Faughard. This kingly parley was held on an island off the Methian shore, called afterwards King's Island. But little good came of it. Both parties still held their own views, so that the satirical poets asked what was the use of the island when one party would not come upon the land, nor the other upon the sea. However, we needs must agree with King Donogh that war is the last resort, and is only to be tried when all other means have failed. Twice during this reign the whole island was stricken with panic, by extraordinary signs in the heavens, of huge serpents coiling themselves through the stars, of fiery bolts flying like shuttles from one side of the horizon to the other, or shooting downward directly to the earth. These atmospheric wonders were accompanied by thunder and lightning, so loud and so prolonged, that men hid themselves for fear in the caverns of the earth. The fairs and markets were deserted by buyers and sellers. The fields were abandoned by the farmers. Steeples were rent by lightning, and fell to the ground. The shingled roofs of churches caught fire and burned whole buildings. Shocks of earthquakes were also felt, and round towers and cyclopean masonry were strewn in fragments upon the ground. These visitations first occurred in the second year of Donogh, and returned again in 783, when, in the next decade, the first Danish descent was made on the coast of Ulster, A.D. 794. These signs and wonders were superstitiously supposed to have been the precursors of that far more terrible and more protracted visitation. The Danes at first attracted little notice, but in the last year of Donogh, A.D. 797, they returned in greater force, and swept rapidly along the coast of Meath. It was reserved for his successors of the following centuries to face the full brunt of this new national danger. But before encountering the fierce nations of the north, and the stormy period they occupy, let us cast back a loving glance over the world-famous schools and scholars of the last two centuries. Hitherto we have only spoken of certain saints in connection with high affairs of state. We must now follow them to the college and the cloister. We must consider them as founders at home and missionaries abroad. Otherwise, how could we estimate all that is at stake for Erin and for Christendom in the approaching combat with the devotees of Odin, the deadly enemies of all Christian institutions? End of Chapter 7. Recording by Laura Koskinen.
Chapter 8 of A Popular History of Ireland, Book 1. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For further information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. A Popular History of Ireland from the Earliest Period to the Emancipation of the Catholics, Book 1, by Thomas D'Arcy McGee. Chapter 8. What the Irish Schools and Saints Did in the Three First Christian Centuries. We have now arrived at the close of the third century from the death of St. Patrick, and find ourselves on the eve of a protracted struggle with the heathen warriors of Scandinavia. It is time, therefore, to look back on the interval we have passed, and see what changes have been wrought in the land since its kings, instead of waiting to be attacked at home, had made the surrounding sea foam with the oars of their outgoing expeditions. The most obvious change in the condition of the country is traceable in its constitution and laws, into every part of which, as was its wont from the beginning, the spirit of Christianity sought patiently to infuse itself. We have already spoken of the expurgation of the constitution, which prohibited the observance of pagan rites to the kings, and imposed on them instead certain social obligations. This was a first change suggested by St. Patrick, and executed mainly by his disciple St. Benignus. We have seen the legislative success which attended the measures of Columbkill, Molling, and Adamnan. In other reforms of minor importance, the paramount influence of the clerical order may be easily traced. But it is in their relation as teachers of human and divine science that the Irish saints exercised their greatest power, not only over their own countrymen, but over a considerable part of Europe. The intellectual leadership of Western Europe, the glorious ambition of the greatest nations, has been in turn obtained by Italy, France, Britain, and Germany. From the middle of the 6th to the middle of the 8th century, it will hardly be disputed that that leadership devolved on Ireland. All the circumstances of the 6th century helped to confer it upon the newly converted Western Isle. The number of her schools, and the wisdom, energy, and zeal of her masters, retained for her the proud distinction for 200 years, and when it passed away from her grasp, she might still console herself with the grateful reflection that the power she had founded and exercised was divided among British and continental schools, which her own alumni had largely contributed to form and establish. In the northern province, the schools most frequented were those of Armagh and of Bangor on Belfast Loch. In Meath, the school of Clonard, and that of Clonmacnois near Athlone. In Leinster, the school of Tarmon, and Beg Erin, the former near the banks of the Slaney, the latter in Wexford Harbour. In Munster, the school of Lismore on the Blackwater, and of Mungret, now Limerick, on the Shannon. In Connaught, the school of Mayo of the Saxons, and the schools of the Isles of Arran. These seats of learning were almost all erected on the banks of rivers, in situations easy of access to the native or foreign student, a circumstance which proved most disastrous to them when the sea kings of the north began to find their way to the shores of the island. They derived their maintenance not from taxing their pupils, but in the first instance from public endowments. They were essentially free schools, not only free as to the lessons given, but, the venerable Bede tells us, they supplied free bed and board and books to those who resorted to them from abroad. The prince and the clansmen of every principality in which a school was situated endowed it with a certain share, often an ample one, of the common land of the clan. Exclusive rights of fishery and exclusive mill privileges seem also to have been granted. As to timber for building purposes and for fuel, it was to be had for carrying and cutting. The right of quarry went with the soil wherever building stone was found. In addition to these means of sustenance, a portion of the collegiate clergy appeared to have discharged missionary duty and received offerings of the produce of the land. We hear of periodical quests or collections made for the sustenance of these institutions, wherein the learned lectors and doctors, no doubt, pleaded their claims to popular favour with irresistible eloquence. Individuals anxious to promote the spread of religion and of science endowed particular institutions out of their personal means. Princes, bishops, and pious ladies contributed to enlarge the bounds and increase the income of their favourite foundations, until a generous emulation seems to have seized on all the great families, as well as on the different provinces, as to which could boast the most largely attended schools and the greatest number of distinguished scholars. The love of the alma mater, that college patriotism which is so sure a sign of the noble-minded scholar, never received more striking illustration than among the graduates of those schools. Columbkill, in his new home among the Hebrides, invokes blessings on blessings on the angels with whom it was once his happiness to walk in Arran, and Columbanus, beyond the Alps, remembers with pride the school of Bangor, the very name of which inspires him with poetic rapture. The buildings in which so many scholars were housed and taught must have been extensive. Some of the schools we have mentioned were, when most flourishing, frequented by 1, 2, 3, and even at some periods as many as 7,000 scholars. Such a population was alone sufficient to form a large village, and if we add the requisite number of teachers and attendants, we will have an addition of at least 1/3 to the total. The buildings seem to have been separately of no great size, but were formed into streets, and even into something like wards. Armagh was divided into three parts: Trian Mawr, or the town proper, Trian Patrick, the cathedral close, and Trian Sassenach, the Latin quarter, the home of the foreign students. A tall sculptured cross, dedicated to some favourite saint, stood at the bounds of these several wards, reminding the anxious student to invoke their spiritual intercession as he passed by. Early hours and vigilant night watches had to be exercised to prevent conflagrations in such village seminaries built almost wholly of wood and roofed with reeds or shingles. A cathedral or an abbey church, a round tower, or a cell of some of the ascetic masters would probably be the only stone structure within the limits. To the students, the evening star gave the signal for retirement and the morning sun for awaking. When, at the sound of the early bell, 2,000 or 3,000 of them poured into the silent streets and made their way towards the lighted church to join in the service of matins, mingling as they went or returned the tongues of the Gael, the Cimbri, the Pict, the Saxon, and the Frank, or hailing and answering each other in the universal language of the Roman Church, the angels in heaven must have loved to contemplate the union of so much perseverance with so much piety. The lives of the masters, not less than their lessons, were studied and observed by their pupils. At that time, as we gather from every authority, they were models of simplicity. One bishop is found erecting with his own hands the cashel or stone enclosure which surrounded his cell. Another is labouring in the field and gives his blessing to his visitors, standing between the stilts of the plough. Most ecclesiastics work occasionally either in wood, in bronze, in leather, or as scribes. The decorations of the church, if not the entire structure, was the work of those who served at the altar. The tabernacle, the rood screen, the ornamental font, the vellum on which the psalms and gospels were written, the ornamented case which contained the precious volume, were often of their making. The music which made the Vale of Bangor resound as if inhabited by angels was their composition. The hymns that accompanied it were their own. It is a poor church that has no music, is one of the oldest Irish proverbs, and the antiphonarium of Bangor, as well as that of Armagh, remains to show that such a want was not left unsupplied in the early church. All the contemporary schools were not of the same grade, nor of equal reputation. We constantly find a scholar, after passing years in one place, transferring himself to another, and sometimes to a third and a fourth. Some masters were, perhaps, more distinguished in human science, others in divinity. Columbkill studied in 2 or 3 different schools, and visited others, perhaps as disputant or lecturer, a common custom in later years. Nor should we associate the idea of underage with the students of whom we speak. Many of them, whether as teachers or learners, or combining both characters together, reached middle life before they ventured as instructors upon the world. 40 years is no uncommon age for the graduate of those days, when as yet the discovery was unmade that all sufficient wisdom comes with the first trace of down upon the chin of youth. The range of studies seems to have included the greater part of the collegiate course of our own times, the language of the country and the language of the Roman Church, the languages of Scripture, Greek and Hebrew, the logic of Aristotle, the writings of the fathers, especially of Pope Gregory the Great, who appears to have been a favourite author with the Irish Church, the defective physics of the period, mathematics, music, and poetical composition went to complete the largest course. When we remember that all the books were manuscripts, that even paper had not yet been invented, that the best parchment was equal to so much beaten gold, and a perfect manuscript was worth a king's ransom, we may better estimate the difficulties in the way of the scholar of the 7th century. Knowing these facts, we can very well credit that part of the story of St. Columbkill's banishment into Argyll, which turns on what might be called a copyright dispute, in which the monarch took the side of St. Finian of Clonard, whose original manuscripts his pupil seems to have copied without permission, and the Clan Conall stood up, of course, for their kinsmen. This dispute is even said to have led to the affair of Cool Drum in Sligo, which is sometimes mentioned as the Battle of the Book. The same tendency of the national character which overstocked the bardic order becomes again visible in its Christian schools, and if we could form anything like an approximate census of the population anterior to the northern invasions, we would find that the proportion of ecclesiastics was greater than has existed either before or since in any Christian country. The vast designs of missionary zeal drew off large bodies of those who had entered holy orders. Still, the numbers engaged as teachers in the great schools, as well as of those who passed their lives in solitude and contemplation, must have been out of all modern proportion to the lay inhabitants of the island. The most eminent Irish saints of the 5th century were St. Ebar, St. Benignus, and St. Kieran of Ossory. In the 6th, St. Bendon of Clonfert, St. Brendan of Birr, St. Macartin of Clogher, St. Finian of Moville, St. Finbar, St. Canis, St. Finian of Clonard, and St. Yarlath of Tuam. In the 7th century, St. Fursey, St. Lasserian, Bishop of Lichlin, St. Kieran, Abbot of Clonmacnish, St. Comgall, Abbot of Bangor, St. Carthage, Abbot of Lismore, St. Colman, Bishop of Dromore, St. Molling, Bishop of Ferns, St. Colman Ella, Abbot, St. Cumian the White, St. Fintan, Abbot, St. Gal, Apostle of Switzerland, St. Fridolin, the Traveller, St. Columbanus, Apostle of Burgundy and Lombardy, St. Killian, Apostle of Franconia, St. Columbkill, Apostle of the Picts, St. Cormac, called the Navigator, St. Cuthbert, and St. Aidan, Apostle of Northumbria. In the 8th century, the most illustrious names are St. Cataldus, Bishop of Tarentum, St. Adamnan, Abbot of Iona, St. Rumold, Apostle of Brabant, Clement and Albinus, the Wisdom Seekers, and St. Fergal or Virgilius, Bishop of Salzburg. Of holy women in the same ages, we have some account of St. Samhan in the 8th century, of St. Bees, St. Dimpna, and St. Syra in the 7th century, and of St. Monina, St. Ita of Desis, and St. Bride or Bridget of Kildare in the 6th. The number of conventual institutions for women established in those ages is less easily ascertained than the number of monastic houses for men, but we may suppose them to have borne some proportion to each other, and to have even counted by hundreds. The veneration in which St. Bridget was held during her life led many of her countrywomen to embrace the religious state, and no less than 14 saints, her namesakes, are recorded. It was the custom of those days to call all holy persons who died in the odour of sanctity saints. Hence national or provincial tradition venerates very many names, which the reader may look for in vain in the Roman calendar. The intellectual labours of the Irish schools, besides the task of teaching such immense numbers of men of all nations on their own soil, and the missionary conquests, to which I have barely alluded, were diversified by controversies, partly scientific and partly theological, such as the Easter controversy, the Tonsure controversy, and that maintained by Fergal the Geometer, as to the existence of the Antipodes. The discussion as to the proper time of observing Easter, which had occupied the doctors of the Council of Nice in the 4th century, was raised in Ireland and in Britain early in the 6th, and complete uniformity was not established till far on in the 8th. It occupied the thoughts of several generations of the chief men of the Irish Church, and some of their arguments still fortunately survive, to attest their learning and tolerance, as well as their zeal. St. Patrick had introduced in the 5th century the computation of time then observed in Gaul, and to this custom many of the Irish doctors rigidly adhered, long after the rest of Christendom had agreed to adopt the Alexandrian computation. Great names were found on both sides of the controversy. Columbanus, Fintan, and Aidan, for adhering exactly to the rule of St. Patrick, Cumaean the White, Lazarian, and Adamnan, in favour of strict agreement with Rome and the East. Monks of the same monastery and bishops of the same province maintained opposite opinions with equal ardour and mutual charity. It was a question of discipline, not a matter of faith, but it involved a still greater question, whether national churches were to plead the inviolability of their local usages, even on points of discipline, against the sense and decision of the universal church. In the year of our Lord 630, the Synod of Leichlin was held, under the shelter of the ridge of Leinster, and the presidency of St. Lacerian. Both parties at length agreed to send deputies to Rome, as children to their mother, to learn her decision. 3 years later, that decision was made known, and the Midland and Southern dioceses at once adopted it. The northern churches, however, still held out, under the lead of Armagh and the influence of Iona, nor was it till a century later that this scandal of celebrating Easter on two different days in the same church was entirely removed. In justification of the Roman rule, St. Cumaean, about the middle of the 7th century, wrote his famous epistle to Segenius, abbot of Iona, of the ability and learning of which all modern writers from Archbishop Usher to Thomas More speak in terms of the highest praise. It is one of the few remaining documents of that controversy. A less vital question of discipline arose about the tonsure. The Irish shaved the head in a semicircle from temple to temple, while the Latin usage was to shave the crown, leaving an external circle of hair to typify the crown of thorns. At the Conference of Whitby, AD 664, this was one of the subjects of discussion between the clergy of Iona and those who followed the Roman method, but it never assumed the importance of the Easter controversy. In the following century, an Irish missionary, Virgilius of Salzburg, called by his countryman Fergal the Geometer, was maintaining in Germany, against no less an adversary than St. Boniface, the sphericity of the earth and the existence of Antipodes. His opponents endeavoured to represent him, or really believed him to hold, that there were other men on our earth for whom the Redeemer had not died. On this ground they appealed to Pope Zachary against him, but so little effect had this gross distortion of his true doctrine at Rome, when explanations were given, that Fergal was soon afterwards raised to the See of Salzburg, and subsequently canonised by Pope Gregory the Ninth. In the 9th century we find an Irish geographer and astronomer of something like European reputation in Dicul and Dungal, whose treatises and epistles have been given to the press. Like their compatriot Columbanus, these accomplished men had passed their youth and early manhood in their own country, and to its schools are to be transferred the compliments paid to their acquirements by such competent judges as Muratori, Latron, and Alexander von Humboldt. The origin of the scholastic philosophy which pervaded Europe for nearly 10 centuries has been traced by the learned Mosheim to the same insular source. Whatever may now be thought of the defects or shortcomings of that system, it certainly was not unfavourable either to wisdom or eloquence, since among its professors may be reckoned the names of St. Thomas and St. Bernard. We must turn away our eyes from the contemplation of those days in which were achieved for Ireland the title of the Land of Saints and Doctors. Another era opens before us, and we can already discern the long ships of the north, their monstrous beaks turned towards the Holy Isle, their sides hung with glittering shields, and their benches thronged with fair-haired warriors, chanting as they advance the fierce war-songs of their race. Instead of the monk's familiar voice on the river banks, we are to hear the shouts of strange warriors from a far-off country, and for matin hymn and vesper song we are to be beset through a long and stormy period with sounds of strife and terror and deadly conflict. End of chapter 8.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.